It's time to talk about trains. I am not an anorak. I have never owned a turtleneck sweater or camped under railway bridges with a pair of oversized binoculars. But I have to say that trains are by far my favourite means of transport when they're on time, when the trip costs less than a weekend holiday and the cars aren't so thoroughly overcrowded that you disembark feeling like a well-used tube of toothpaste. Done well, trains are, I think, the most civilised way to travel. They take up very little space compared to roads and cause far less harm to the countryside than acres of cracked tarmac. I also think trains are worth looking at because we can learn a lot from how they operate. The railway is a complicated system, but one whose aims are easy to understand. Railways want to move people and things across large distances, quickly, safely, cheaply, comfortably, and reliably. But in order to achieve these simple objectives, they rely on a very complex system of rails, engines, signals, buildings, pricing systems, and so on. Put simply, railways are complex enough that by studying them, you can get a sense of the importance of the devils in the detail, without losing sight of the utility of the system as a whole. Finally, the history of British railways tells us a lot about the politics of this country. If British Railways were a movie, it would be an 18-plus slasher horror film in which everything is brutally murdered for no reason by a succession of deranged politicians and civil servants. Not to mention the maddest axeman of them all, Richard Beeching. I'm joined today by Carl.
Hello.
And together we're going to travel first class through the wild history of British Railways. We may take the scenic route at times, but please remain on board for the duration of this unique journey. So, Carl, you've come from a scenic, unique British railway town in Swindon.
I'm not from Swindon, actually. My family lives near here, and so I ended up here. Mm-hmm. But I do use the trains quite a lot, actually. You know, I actually agree with you. I actually really like train travel as a means of travel, just because, if nothing else, like you say, it is rather civilized. You know, you can sit down, you can have your tea, you can read a book, you know, whatever it is, and enjoy the scenery. And it should be fast, safe, effective, and comfortable. Mm-hmm. And it's not, at least, quick, effective, and comfortable.
Well, it's sort of like we know what the five criteria are, and it usually manages, on a good day, three of them.
That's a very good day, yeah.
Right. Sometimes none of them.
Yeah. Well, the safety issue is probably the one that they're best at.
Yes. Actually, British railways are the safest in Europe and have been for quite some time.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think there was a train accident like a decade ago that was everywhere, but that highlights just how few train accidents we have. Mm. You know, it's so rare that it's like, right, okay, well, at least this is one thing they can do well. I mean, that's the only thing that I'm really impressed with about the railway system. Everything else is pretty terrible.
I don't know. So I'm actually of the opinion that I think the railways get a lot more flack than they deserve.
Possibly.
Now, I think that this description is absolutely true from around the late 90s to the probably early 2010s. Mm. But personally, as someone who's been using the railway system consistently for 15 years, I feel like it is steadily getting better and better year on year, just slightly more civilized, less stupendously delayed, cancelled, and on strike, and God knows what.
I have to use the railways regularly as well, and it's not necessarily the railway's fault that this is the case, but the overcrowding is a massive issue to me.
Yes, I agree. Yeah. And I feel
that's not their fault, as I said. You
know. Well, I don't know. I feel like it is their fault in a way, because part of the overcrowding, I think, comes from an incentive system, which means that if you're delayed by a certain amount, you can claim your ticket price back. But if you're crammed into a carriage that's way overstuffed because they've cancelled half the train because it missed a connection or whatever it may be, you can't claim any refund for that. I do wonder whether that motivates it somehow.
Well, I also noticed that there seemed, it used to be, like, I have memories of about a decade ago where getting the train to London, there'd be like eight carriages on the train. And I got the train from London the other day, and there were only four carriages on it. I'm thinking, okay, that's bound to be about cost efficiency and things like that. But of course, that makes the journey itself massively uncomfortable. Mm. So, yeah, maybe it is partially.
I think it also combines with the fact that I usually travel by train on weekends, and that's usually when there's all of the engineering work, when things are most likely to be delayed, carriages cancelled, and also when it's most popular for people to go travelling up to London, which is the usual route from here. And so you inevitably end up just stuffed onto these trains.
I went on holiday to visit my parents about a month ago, and it was unbelievable how hot and packed the train was. Mm. It was really, really uncomfortable. Mm. So I'm rather cynical about the railway.
It can be really bad, but then when I compare it to 15 years ago, at least now the trains are a lot cleaner than they used to be. They used to be absolutely manky.
That's true.
They even have Wi-Fi these days. If you do get a seat, it's likely to be very comfortable. You'll have places to put your luggage and so on. So, and also, having experienced the German railway system not too long ago, I actually think the British system is pretty good because the German one is terrible.
Really?
Well, again, the trains are comfortable, but they do not do very well with punctuality.
Well, that's a shock.
I know. They have a reputation outside of Germany. But, because Germans are efficient, their train system must be amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's really not.
Right, okay.
But anyway, that's just a brief taster of the rail system as it is today. But what we're going to do is we're going to take a crash course in the early history of steam and railway and zoom through that towards the major policy changes that took place in the post-war period that left our poor railways in the brutalized state that they find themselves in.
Just before you into it, didn't we invent the railway system?
Yes.
Right. So you'd think ours would be the most advanced and best.
Well, yes, you would think we would have some pride in our railways. We'd see them as an intangible cultural heritage.
Perhaps. Yes, this would be, exactly, the pride of Britain, one of them.
Right.
But
no, in a very British way, it seems like the elite classes have poo-pooed it to such an extent that they've been able to destroy it. And we will get into that harrowing history later on in this podcast.
But that is very frustrating as well, because like you're saying, it is a civilized way of travel. Mm. One of the things I do like is when they bring around the refreshments trolley, right? And, you know, it keeps the kids occupied for 10, 15 minutes while they choose some refreshments and then eat them. And it's just, you know, there's certain intangible quality to it that it is civilized, you know, and it is nice when you're sat, you know, on a not entirely packed train going through the sort of West countryside and you know, seeing it all. There is something genuinely nice about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think Peter Hitchens put it very well when he pointed out that the railway is the only way that you can experience the countryside without destroying it by getting there.
Yeah.
So once you lay down a load of roads in the countryside, you irrevocably change its character, whereas you can put a single railway line through, see everything there is to see and not really disturb the environment very much. And if you're keen on environmentalism in another kind, you could point out that actually in terms of energy efficiency, it's far greater than
most number of people transported per carbon footprint tonnage or something.
Yeah.
Whatever the metric
kilogram
is.
Of CO2 equivalent.
Yeah. It's got to be highly efficient, right?
Incredibly so.
You're transporting hundreds of people on one single train. Mm-hmm.
And that's why, at last, one of the good things coming out of the climate debate is that governments are at last seeing railway as an asset and not a burden. It's amazing. It's inconceivable to me, born in the 90s, how the people who destroyed our railway system got away with it.
I honestly look forward to learning how, because I've always been... This is the reason I asked to do this one. It's not the most sexy subject, but I do think it's important. I think there is something... more than just like the economic factors as well. It's like you're saying, it is part of our cultural heritage and we should take it a bit more seriously.
Absolutely. So when we say part of our cultural heritage, we are harking back to the depths of history. And the story of steam actually begins in coal pits, which is a very good place to start with this British history. So we have the earliest steam engines being used to essentially move, water and coal up and down mine shafts. And the first one invented, I believe, by Thomas Savery in this country in 1698.
Oh, wow.
It's a long time ago.
I didn't realize it was that long ago.
Yeah, so that's, 324 years ago?
Yeah.
Now, obviously, it took a while for these to actually become functional steam engines. These were atmospheric engines, and they were a bit of a novelty, though they did have some practical use. Following that, you have major innovations by Thomas Newcomen, who invented, I believe, the first piston steam engine in 1712. And then James Watt, of course, in 1763. But during this period, you have a gradual evolution of this technology, which at the time, I don't think anyone really connects with the idea of locomotion. It's amazing that they were working on this technology, it'll make the mines more efficient and we can move move various things away from the pit head and closer to transport links and so on and so forth. And they're playing at the very foothills of the Industrial Revolution. It's almost like building a sandcastle at the foot of a volcano. It's that kind of feeling you get. So that's quite good, a bit of inventive heritage there. Then in 1802, we have Richard Trevithick with the first high-pressure steam engine and steam locomotive. So 220 years ago, we can date this too. Funnily enough, Richard Trevithick was described by one of his schoolmasters as a disobedient, slow, obstinate, spoiled boy, frequently absent and very inattentive.
But that actually is interesting because intelligent and creative types often feel constrained by the school system.
Especially the 1802 school system.
I imagine it was very constraining, yes.
And his schoolmaster said as well that he was only good at one thing, which was arithmetic. It's a good start.
That is a good start.
But he tended to solve problems in creative and unusual ways rather than the ways he was supposed to.
Excellent. I can see why he was the guy.
Natural born engineer.
Yeah.
Now, his life is very interesting. He's obviously Trevithick is a very Cornish name, came from Cornwall. He ended up traveling the world. Like many people in this period, he made his fortune and lost it and made it again and lost it. Had a lot of ups and downs. At one point, he was stranded in Costa Rica after nearly having been eaten by an alligator. He bumped into Robert Stevenson, another great man of the steam age. They had nothing in common, but Stevenson lent him 50 quid to get back home on the steamer, where he arrived back in England with virtually nothing except the clothes on his back, according to the story. So this is the early 1800s, but George Stevenson is someone who really takes it forward with his imaginatively named Locomotion No. 1. This runs the Stockton and Darlington Railway in 1825, and it's one of the first examples of a reliable working high-pressure steam engine at the front of a locomotive that's working in commercial service. The next mark on our timeline is in 1829 with the famous Rainhill Trials and Stevenson's Rocket. Have you heard of the Rocket?
I haven't.
So the Rainhill Trials were an interesting scheme. Basically, there was a set of railways being built between Liverpool and Manchester. But at the time, there wasn't really an understanding that railways mean you have the railways down, then you have wagons pulled by a locomotive. A lot of people were thinking at the time that you would have a stationary engine at one end of the track and it would basically pull the cars to and fro, a bit like, say, a ski lift.
Excuse me. Yeah.
And so that was what they were envisaging. And then I believe it was Stevenson pushed very heavily for actually using a locomotive instead. Now, as a result of this argument, they ended up producing the Rainhill Trials, which were a competition to see which mad inventor's steam locomotive was best suited for this new railway.
It was a different time, wasn't it?
I know, it's great.
yeah.
I do love the early trials that happen. You see the same in aviation as well.
Oh, yeah,
they have
these
competitions, a load of mad, insanely rich and stupid aristocrats turn up and risk their lives flying highly experimental flying prototypes
around. Yes. Yeah,
but
you can
only
imagine how many people died.
But they died in a rather noble way, you could say. I mean, okay, there is the famous guy who jumped off the Eiffel Tower with a pair of wings that didn't work.
Yes.
But, you know, not everyone is quite that stupid.
Yeah.
And George Stevenson certainly wasn't. So he came in with the Rocket. There were a number of other contraptions on display. One of them was literally a Shire horse standing on a drive belt, which stood on a bed with wheels.
I mean, I can see how he thinks it's going to work.
I mean, technically, it didn't meet the rules because it wasn't steam-powered and so on. Yeah. But they let it run anyway. Huh. And it did quite well for a couple of laps until the horse's feet broke through the drive wheel and it had to be towed off.
I mean, Shire horses are big animals, you know. You've got to watch them.
And I believe the track was essentially an oval of rail, and you had to go around it lots of times, making up the distance of about 25, 35 kilometers, which was the planned distance. And there were a load of rules as to how much water you could carry, how much coal you could carry. The water in the boilers had to be cold at the start, and they measured the speed and so on. There was also a very experimental device called Novelty, but it didn't work, unfortunately. It started off on the first day, overtook all the competitors, built up a huge head of steam, went at near 40 kilometers an hour, I think. So very fast.
Yeah, for the time.
And then it broke down subsequently and was very unreliable in numerous ways. But I believe the railway acquired it anyway. But it was Stevenson's locomotive that really won the day, because not only did it work, it started slow, and then by the end of the trials, it was beating a Novelty speed record on the first day. But it was also just reliable. It was the tried and tested product of a lot of innovation and iteration upon a good design.
Mm.
So the Rainhill Trials in 1829 are a good place to start to date the start of the railway revolution? Because here you have the first locomotive as we would recognize it today. You'd look at it and say, it's a steam engine. So the Liverpool and Manchester Railway cost £637,000 in 1830.
Which must be quite a lot in that time.
Well, it's at least tens of millions today, but it's hard to compare money from historical periods to today, because you could compare that against something which was cheap back then, and it wouldn't seem like a lot. Or you could compare it against the price of a house, which is really expensive today, and you could point out that maybe you could buy hundreds of houses for that price.
Mm.
And that puts it into a bit more perspective. Mm. Really, though, we're in the Victorian era now. As we get towards 1840, we have what's known as the railway mania. And this period is often talked about in terms of the railways because it's a good example of a period of free market railway, which supporters of private and free railways, free market railways, tend to support. Because in this period, you get a huge amount of railway built all over the country. Detractors will argue that a lot of these railways weren't efficient, which is absolutely true. And they will also argue that it's not really free market anyway, because you can't just turn up somewhere and lay down a load of railway track. Oh, no, no, no. In an era where you need a writ from Parliament to close a road, you needed a bill from Parliament to say you could build the railway or not. Mm. You can probably start to see where this is going.
Yes.
So you have a load of inventors who are coming up to Parliament and saying, oh, I've got a plan for a railway. It'll make this and that much money. It'll be this gauge. It'll run these engines, etc., etc. And of course, Parliament passes nearly all of them. They reject some which are openly fraudulent, because of course, many people see this as a way of getting rich. Yeah. But because this coincides with a time of low interest, people are not so interested in government bonds, so they're moving their investment out of government bonds into railway bonds. Mm. So you start to get a speculation bubble building.
Right.
Loads of people pouring their life savings, in some cases, into railway stocks. In some cases, they only had enough money to actually buy the deposit on the stocks, trusting that it would make a profit, because this was advertised all over the country as a sure cash in, a bit like the height of the crypto bubble or the South Seas bubble, things like this. This also started 10 years after the government revoked the Bubble Act, which had been in place since the South Seas bubble and required that the private company could only be owned by a maximum of 5 investors, for example.
Right.
So you get loads of people pouring their money into this, which means loads of people build railways all over the place. The government is approving almost all of them because, come on, these politicians have stocks in the railways that they're passing. It's not rocket science.
Yeah.
So the government's making a fortune. Inventors are usually making a fortune. The public's getting loads of railway track built. We lay down ultimately 23,000 route miles of railway track, more than double what we have today. Foreshadowing.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I did not know that.
Yep. And everyone's winning, except of course it is a bubble. So at the height of the craze in 1846, 263 railway bills were passed in Parliament.
And how popular were the railways with the public? I mean, were they using them?
Yes. No. Right. There was a huge craze for them. They were novel for a start, and people saw it as the literal engine of progress, which it was. Mm. It enabled you. This is before motor cars, when your only means of transportation is by horse. Mm. It enabled you to get from one end of the country to another in a reasonably inexpensive, if mightily uncomfortable, fashion.
Were they that uncomfortable back then, were they?
Well, it depends on what year you're talking about, because the railways are a bit of a political football.
Right.
And around this time, well, after, this is going ahead a bit, but Gladstone attempts to make the railways more of a public good. He introduces rules saying that railways have to have so-called parliamentary trains, which are third-class carriages carrying the poor rather than just being playthings for the rich, because he believes, first of all, this is egalitarian and good for the country, but also that it will stimulate economic growth and make the railways more popular as a whole if everyone's using them. But of course, companies then respond to this by meeting the bare minimum requirements of the law in order to not come up with censure and producing some incredibly cramped, airless, sunless carriages, which are basically cattle trains.
Yeah.
You know, it's exactly what you'd expect.
Yes.
But the craze then ends in about 1847. The whole bubble collapses. Many families, especially middle-class families, have their savings completely wiped out. Many railway companies just go under. And so what happens is the larger companies, including Great Western Rail, based here in Swindon, are able to go around and buy up all the competition for knockdown prices and start to establish an oligopoly over the British railway network, where everything is owned by a small number of fanatically wealthy and very influential companies and entrepreneurs. Gladstone then attempts to nationalise the railways, but he doesn't succeed. It gets watered down step by step.
Gladstone, the famous Liberal Prime Minister.
Yes.
Yes.
So I think Gladstone was actually one of the greatest statesmen of British history. Mm. I think that's a widely held view. There are recordings of his voice, which you can listen to online. And he speaks like one of these Victorian gentlemen of whom Churchill's manner of speaking, which we think of as very characteristic, is just an echo. He's described memorably by Bertrand Russell, who met him at the dinner table when Bertrand was 16. Bertrand's parents, I believe, had died. He lived with his grandmother. And so he was left alone with Gladstone for port after dinner, because, of course, the ladies retired to another room, as was customary. So this 16-year-old is sitting with the greatest statesman of the age. He described as an experience which seared him with terror, and nothing since has frightened him.
I can't even begin to doubt that. Like, I'm 42 and I would be the same.
He's described as having an incredible presence. Mm. This is in the age before microphones, so he has this great bellowing voice that can carry across an open square full of thousands of people. So literally he'll be shouting at you at the top of his voice in this great Roman style.
Yeah.
He's also described as having these very powerful and intense eyes, like a basilisk that can sort of silence you with a glance.
And the thing is, if anyone's ever watched any of Bertrand Russell speaking, he's not like that.
No.
He's considered and quiet and measured, and he's a philosopher, you know. He's not a politician. So yeah, that must have been very interesting for poor old Bertrand.
Absolutely. You must feel sorry for him. Just one more Gladstone anecdote. He's one of my favourite historical figures. There's a period where he's giving a speech, and his opposition within the party, I think, have brought a drunk in off the street, paid him a bit of money and said, just mess up the speech, disrupt it. So he sits in the front rank heckling Gladstone throughout. And then Gladstone just turns around and says, may I require of that gentleman who, if he were in my position, if I were in his position and he in mine, I would do him the courtesy. Or just goes on, top of his voice, glaring at this guy, basically tells him to shut up in a very polite Victorian way. Apparently he never uttered another word.
well, what are you going to say?
Incredible. Yeah. The fact that you could have this physical presence in those days, before radio, before television, before remote communication, when everything was in person. Anyway, slight deviation onto the...
But yeah, the only reason I bring up is because, I mean, there is quite a... Like you were saying, you can't just have a free market in railroads, really. Because the actual infrastructure required is a bit prohibitive. I can see why, like, the famous Liberal Prime Minister Gladstone would be like, well, there is actually a liberal argument for nationalisation of railroads.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a deeper discussion, which we'll maybe get onto a bit more during the discussions about privatisation, because there is an argument that you can make railways completely free market up to a point, because fundamentally you can't just allow people to go building railways through people's back gardens without so much as a buy your leave. And that's where the free market argument starts to fall down. And it's unrealistic to expect sometimes hundreds, sometimes thousands of people to just give up the rights for a railway to be built through their back garden, because all it takes is one person to say, oh no, actually, I like my garden the way it is.
I don't think I'll be assenting to this. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, we can see the results of it now. I mean, we're at the mercy of Great Western. If you want to travel on the trains, you have one option. So this is hardly a free market. Mm-hmm. I literally have no choice.
Yes.
So...
Yeah, they had an idea that you would get red trains and green trains traveling on the same tracks, and customers would compete as to which service was better. But of course, if you're traveling from place to place, unless one of the trains is a literal death wagon, you're going to get on the first train that arrives at the station, because you just want to get to your destination quickly. Anyway.
That's exactly right.
So I'm going to skim over the rest of this age of of Victorian railways. It's probably worth mentioning the Battle of the Gauges, which usually comes up. So Brunel of the Great Western Railway had this luxurious 7 foot and 1/4 inch railway gauge. So this is the distance that the tracks are set apart. And this meant that he could have very wide, very stable, very comfortable trains running on it. Whereas across the rest of the country, Stephenson had been building narrow gauge, or what's now called standard gauge, 4 foot, 8.5 inches, yes. Which is what we have today. And this was the rest of the system. Now, there are arguments you can throw for and against each one.
I'll take the luxury carriage, thank you very much.
You'd think so, but then you could argue that that encourages more squat trains, which take longer to load and unload. It also means you have a broader air resistance, which in the era of high-speed trains, perhaps not so desired. Maybe you want a thin needle-like one. I've been thinking about this over the last couple of nights. I've been reading up on it because there are arguments to and from. Yeah. It also means you need to clear more land and build wider bridges and so on.
Okay, fair enough.
I don't know if you have any more thoughts on railways. Oh, I should mention this. I'm absolutely certain that some of our commentators will be extremely knowledgeable on the subject of railways. And if you work in that field, if you have some expertise or a long-standing hobby in there, please feel free to round out the points that we're making here with your own expertise and opinions as to, for example, broad gauge versus narrow gauge. Was it a travesty that the government basically demanded that Brunel set his railway to standard gauge to fit the rest of the tracks? Or was that just common sense?
What was Brunel's reason for wanting a wide gauge?
More comfortable.
Right, okay, well, I'm on Brunel's side.
Well, it was then, but you could argue now that trains are... And that argument dies on my lips. I remember trying to write on a modern train.
You could argue... Well, actually, I won't.
But you could argue that modern trains with their stabilization are actually quite comfortable. They are, but you can't exactly write on
them. Yeah.
So let's move forward to the First World War, which is the death of many great things in England, including 1.1 million young men.
Yeah.
So the government takes over trains for the First World War. Up until that point, you still have this oligopoly of numerous companies. I think there were still about 120 railway companies.
Well, that's not terrible. That's
still quite a lot.
That's better than we have now, isn't it?
Yes. But you have problems whereby, for example, the railway operators are charging differential tariffs on each route and each train between each service, often because they have a mate who they go to the club with who has a business in this part which he wants to ship to wherever it may be cheaply. So he'll knock down the prices there and make it up on the other routes and so on. So there, you could argue there's a lot of corruption and interpersonal politics taking place there. And actually, as an individual or as a business, working out how to send a package from one end of the country to another, it was very difficult until the government came in and standardized freight prices. But then this creates a whole other series of problems, which especially begin to arise after the nationalization of road the privatization of road transport. We're getting ahead of ourselves slightly. 1914, the government takes over the trains. They don't nationalize them per se, but they say to the companies, look, we need to run this for the war effort. We need to shift vast quantities of supplies, coal, ammunition, whatever it may be, in order to support the war effort and keep the economy running. So they take over the trains from 1914. And being the government and being in wartime, they massively overuse the railway stock and don't do nearly enough maintenance. So by the time it's eventually handed back to the private companies in 1921, 3 years after the war had ended, the railways are pretty knackered.
Right.
At this point, it's decided not to nationalise it completely, but to create a cartel system called the Big Four. So they split the British railway network into four companies whose names I always forget. You can go and look them up. We might even put them on the edit so that you can see. But essentially, you have Great Western. It's something as literally as stupid as Great Western, Great Northern, Great Southern, and Great Eastern, but it's not quite that simple. Yeah. And this is often seen as a heyday of rail transport. But there are arguments that it wasn't really a heyday of rail transport, that it was in fact a very effective PR campaign for the luxury products of these rail transport that then bought into the whole glitz and glamour of the interwar period with its flappers and its liberalization, its rejection of staid cultural norms of the imperial period and so on, that it ties into all of that and is seen as a silver age of the railways.
Hmm.
Arguably, this wasn't actually the case. A lot We were still running steam railways powered by coal. A lot of it was quite polluting, quite dirty. The trains didn't exactly run on time. They weren't necessarily very cheap. A lot of people would be crammed into small spaces and so on. So there are a lot of arguments to and for whether the Big Four was a nostalgic era that we should look back on emulate, or just a fairly shoddy era with a good PR campaign.
I think it's the good PR campaign. Mm-hmm. And I think Great Western are still leaning on it now. Mm. Have you seen their Famous Five adverts?
I have, yes. Yeah.
It's like, who does this represent? You know, how does this apply to modern Britain?
That's true, but I like the fact that they are recycling that aesthetic, because it shows Britain partly as it was and partly as it could be.
I agree. I'm not dismissing it. I'm just, it just, there's a kind of jarringness to it where it's just like, it's not like that now, you know. And but it could be. Well, yeah. Maybe. Who knows what we'll do in the future.
You don't have four children of one family going down to the seaside wearing their hand-knitted sweaters.
No.
To whom, you know, a cucumber sandwich is the height of achievement and delight. The Famous Five is an interesting cultural phenomenon, but let's not derail ourselves. Let's get back on track. So you have, of course, the Second World War, and doesn't do great things for the railway system. What would you guess happens in the Second World War to the railways?
Well, I'm guessing that the government takes them over again and runs them into the ground again, because they... And in their defense, what choice do they have? You know, you can understand why they would feel the need to do such a thing, but it can't be good.
That's true. They do one good thing here compared to the First World War, which is they make railway workers a protected occupation.
Oh, right. Okay.
Because what they did in the First World War was draft a load of them off to the front, and they realized, oh, bugger, we can't run the transport system.
Right, yeah.
You know, classic British forward thinking.
Yeah.
What happens is all of the companies basically join together into one conglomerate that's looked after by the government, the Big Four. But by 1945, they're more or less knackered. And then in 1948, the momentous decision is taken by Clement Attlee's Revolutionary Labour government to nationalise the railways. This is a very interesting decision, because while I'm a massive opponent of privatisation, I'm not necessarily a spokesman for nationalisation, which might sound contradictory, but it's not a question of which system works better, a nationalised system or a privatised system. It's a question of the transition, because obviously there are huge costs involved in switching from one type of system to the other. More so to privatisation if it's done badly, where you can lose a theoretically infinite amount of money or managerial inefficiency. Foreshadowing.
Don't get me started. Yeah. Let's carry on.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.